nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Lecture series that will eventually be posted on the NanoHub. And the idea is to explain or some of the physics and interesting device work that is being done in the department so that we can share it with people outside the university as well. And the topic that I'll be discussing today is this new technology for micro and macro electronics. Now, the word microelectronics is familiar to you. Of course, this is something we routinely use to describe the area in which we work in. Even our department name has this microelectronics in it, or at least the group that we work with. But the word macro is something that you may not be familiar with. So this will be an interesting way to learn about a new technology that is really, there is a potential that it will transform the way we view electronics. So before I get going, let me acknowledge the collaboration we have. Most of the work actually comes from the collaboration with Professor Jayati Murthy and Ninad Pimperkar and Shatish Kumar did actually most of the work that I'll be showing today. And we had been very fortunate that a large number of experimentalists have also been generally interested in this work, and they routinely share data with us. So I acknowledge the experimentalists and as well as research support from various organizations. I'll start with a background and motivation that why all of a sudden talk about this new type of transistor. After all, in various courses in microelectronics, we talk about MOSFET, MESFET, and all sorts of various types of transistors. Why a new transistor? Then I'll talk about the theory of stick composites. This is a composite made of randomly oriented sticks and the physics that goes with it. And then we'll be talking about its applications, although we'll not have a chance to discuss all the applications. But we'll touch briefly on microelectronics and macroelectronics and then make some concluding remarks. Now, when we talk about electronics, generally we talk about, let's say, computers, and we all know about microprocessors. So this is what would be Moore's law all about, and we want to make this transistor as small as possible. We talk about nanotechnology, by which we can make things even faster on even smaller dimensions. So this is something we are intimately familiar with. On the other hand, there is a big IC. Of course, that IC, the microprocessors, hide underneath the body, let's say. There it will be, if you open this up, you will see the microprocessor, the memory, all sort of sitting underneath the keyboard. But there is another big IC that sits right in front of us, but something that we seldom see. And that has to do with the display. The display is actually a big integrated circuit because each point on the each pixel of the display, we have heard about, let's say, 1,000 by 1,000 pixels. So that will be 1 million pixels. Each pixel in the display actually is controlled by a transistor. And that transistor is, of course, not the microprocessor-like transistor. First of all, the distinction is that the transistor sits on glass substrate. And glass melts at several hundred degrees C, so you cannot make that transistor at very high temperature. So it's a lower performing transistors, but the transistor really controls a huge area. So there may be millions of transistors behind that display that we seldom think about. Turns out that this is an area of very rapid development these days, and that is the topic that we'll be talking about. Now, if you look at the landscape of electronics, This is one way to view it. There is this two axis. One is performance, another is area. And microprocessors like Pentium and others, we can think about sort of occupying the upper left-hand corner, where you see that it has very high performance, gigahertz of performance, but then the area is very small, and we want to make it even smaller, if at all possible. And most of the research in this area is actually making the transistor as small as possible and making the performance as big, as high as possible. That will be successive generations of Pentium, for example, or Moore's law. That's how we would describe the single crystalline silicon electronics. But the other electronics in the display, it sits on sort of the opposite end of the spectrum, where the area is very large, and of course you have millions of transistors, but the performance need not be very fast or very high, because you don't need to turn these pixels on and off millions of times a second, because your eye will not be able to follow it anyway. So a much lower performance transistors that can nonetheless can occupy a big space is what we need for this amorphous silicon-based thin film transistors. The reason this is amorphous silicon compared to the single silicon, single crystalline silicon, is because at lower temperature you want to put this electronics on glass, and the glass will melt if you raise the temperature too much. And at lower enough temperature, actually you cannot make a single crystalline transistor. So therefore these transistors are amorphous silicon, lots of scattering, lower performance, but fine for this application. However, this is changing, because there is this big empty space in between where you want higher performance, but you also want larger area. There are many applications, and I'm going to show you some examples. And here, of course, if there is a better performance material that could really work with large area, that would be wonderful. And in fact, two technologies that you may have often heard about, one is this polysilicon transistor-based technology. By the way, TFT stands for thin film transistors, and I'll be explaining why this is called so. But there is two technologies people talk about. One is thin film polysilicon, and in this case, polysilicon thin film transistor. In this case, the mobility is higher. Of course, it's not as good as single crystalline silicon. Still, it is quite a bit better. However, in order to make polysilicon transistor, of course, the temperature has to be quite high. And in that case, you have to stay with glass substrate. For example, just glass substrate. You cannot go to plastics. If you could go have electronics on plastic substrate, that will be most useful. But at least you can have high performance. If you wanted high performance on glass substrate, this is one way to go. And many companies are pursuing this route. The other approach is to work with organic thin film transistors. Now, these transistors can be deposited at very low temperature. And in this case, the performance is much poorer than, even poorer than amorphous silicon, which is a problem. But at least this can be deposited on plastic substrate. So these would be two big research direction that people are working on. And then there are many, many applications of both these areas. Let me give you a few examples. One example would be that many of us, of course, carry cell phones, and the display on the cell phones, many times it's on glass, but we do not want it to be glass. Glass is heavy and it's prone to breakage. So therefore, it would be much better if we could replace this display with essentially plastic display. It will be cheap, inexpensive. Instead of spending $100 on a cell phone, you could probably reduce the cost quite a bit if the whole display was on plastics. But in this case, you will have to make a display that can be developed on top of plastic, so you cannot raise the temperature very much. There are other applications, many, many other applications that people talk about. For example, has been recently an announcement on Plastic Logic's e-paper. So this is really looks like a paper, and it can be viewed at high angle, looks like almost like a newspaper, but this display can be continuously changed with electronic signal. Sony and Philips have recently talked about this type of reader, which can be rolled in this case, with the palm. It's a small, like a pack of card dimensions, but then it can be rolled out. And they have announced hundreds of books may eventually be available on this type of format. And then, of course, there are watches and other things that people are working on. So there is a huge wave of future electronics that is likely to come from all this if one was successful in this particular type of technologies. By the way, when I saw this particular one, this one looks like almost like from the Minority Report, the film that you have, looks like almost a page out of that, like science fiction. There are other applications people talk about. For example, one of the most expensive areas of monitoring the surface of any large area devices or planes like this is manual monitoring of the surface, if there is a crack or if there is any fault that is developing. And one way people had been working on in changing that is to cover this whole surface with a skin of plastic electronics, and that individual elements have sensor built into it. So as soon as a crack develops in the material, then you can immediately get a response out, and then it will be much safer and much more reliable. But in this case, the electronics is actually covering the entire surface of the material. And in many ways, Bob Roos from DARPA often compares this as like a nervous system, just like human beings have nervous system that essentially carries information everywhere. It is similar to having such a network which will inform the electronics or inform the system of any possible problem with the structure of this aeroplane, for example. So many applications people are talking about, but the problem remains, and this is this problem, and this is the essence. The problem is polysilicon. Anytime you want high performance, you have to use polysilicon. But polysilicon, then you cannot put it on plastic. You say, okay, fine, I will work with organic transistors, which I can put on plastic. I can process in solution, I can put it on plastic. But that you cannot have, it doesn't have very high performance. So the question is, you have either or, and the technology that I'm going to talk about, in fact, instead of being either or, it has both. And this is called a pickup transistor, and again, it has applications in many, many different areas that people are talking about, and several companies have started. So let me first tell you that this is real, in the sense that this technology is not only that is not something that people generally talk about, but there are companies like NanoSys, which have already made conformal solar cells that you can bend, non-plastic, flexible electronics, memory devices. There have been electronics on top of steel. Remember the aircraft, if you want to put electronics on top of the aircraft, you have to be able to have electronics on top of steel. So that you have artificial skins, all sorts of applications people are working on. So how do you have this advantage of both high performance and as well as plastic substrate? How do you have both? And the way to have both is this following way. You can either have silicon nanowire or carbon nanotube. On the top left, you have silicon nanowire that you grow on a temporary substrate at very high temperature. So each one of the sticks that you see are actually single crystalline silicon that have grown out of a temporary substrate. You can also grow carbon nanotube in chemical vapor deposition CVD systems or by laser arc, and essentially can have very high single crystalline system defined that way. Then you can detach those sticks, put them in solution, and then put the solution on top of plastic. So this you could do at room temperature because that's solution processing. You have a bunch of sticks floating on the on this solution, that you can put it here, but each one of the lines that you see, each one of the sticks, are actually processed at very high temperature so that they are single crystalline. This technology, therefore, would have the advantage of nearly single crystalline transport on plastic substrate. So that's good. That's something we'd like to have. And already people are using such a system to define electronics. The question, of course, is, then you want to make a transistor out of it, and the way you'd make a transistor is that you'll put a thin film of this material, shown here in gray, thin film of this material containing these sticks, and then you will put it on top of a substrate, and this is green, shown here in green, called a gate. In this case, the gate could be glass, so you put it on top of a glass substrate. The red is source and drain, so when you apply a gate bias and a drain bias, current will flow from the source through these sticks to the drain. This is what you would like to make out of it. And of course, the individual sticks could be silicon nanowire, or it could be carbon nanotube. So each one of the sticks could be a nanowire or nanotube or a nanowire. That really doesn't matter, so long you get the basic configuration. And you can also see why this is called a thin film transistors, because you have a very thin film as a conducting layer on top of glass. That gives you the transistor performance. Hence, its name is a thin film transistor. Now, the question is that how would you describe transport through such a system? See, this looks nice. So, one thing people would immediately do, and they have done for some time, is that since we do not know how to treat such a system, you know, this material has a random set of sticks. We haven't seen this type of system before. The question is, how would you do it? Now, there are two approaches. First is that you say, since I do not know anything about this material, I'll treat it as based on what I already know. And what we already know is how to treat transport in a crystalline material. So, although this is not a crystalline material, for example, you can see polysilicon on the top, carbon nanotube or silicon nanowire, completely random material, we can homogenize this and treat it like a crystal, effective crystal. So we'll locally homogenize the medium and then use the theory of crystal to approximate the property of a random media. In other words, what you would like to do is that if you had, for example, a polysilicon transistor, this is the top view, for example, that you are looking into the channel region, and it has random configurations of conducting and non-conducting region, then you will effectively replace, keeping the proportion the same, black and open circles, keeping the proportion the same, you make a periodic structure out of it. And then consider the transport through this periodic structure using the theory of crystals. That is one way. And if you wanted to do the same thing for this stick percolation system, you'd do the same. You'd have this random set of sticks and you will put them in regular grid and then try to find the transport through this structure. The whole point of today's presentation is that although this approach works reasonably well for amorphous media, this approach doesn't work at all for composites. So let me show why that's the case. But before that, let's see what is already available in literature so that we can get a good starting point that we can describe such a random system. It turns out that people have been discussing such a random system for a long time, although not for this application. And what I show in that corner is called a Poisson line process, where you have random sticks of infinite length laid down on a two-dimensional surface. And what is amazing, that it's possible to mathematically find out how many crossing points you have. For example, what is the size distribution of the white spaces? All this can be mathematically computed. And in fact, that forms the basis of many of the products that you already know. For example, the aerosol filter so that you can catch particles of multiple sizes using the same filter. The reason underlying theory is based on the Poisson line process, because that has a variable opening, and that opening essentially can catch particles of different sizes. People also do analysis of the reflectivity of different types of paper. For example, in the corner, what you see, number one, on the top left corner, you see that this is a background filter on top of which you have wood particles, wood sticks, or small wood chips that essentially you catch, and depending on the density of this wood, little wood sticks, then correspondingly the reflectivity of the paper, that would be changing, again based on Poisson line process. And even problems like this, where you want to compute the grid length in a telecommunication grid in a particular city, again the same mathematics, the same process. This is great. Only problem is, this does not address the problem that we are interested in. It gives you the geometry of the problem, but it does not tell you that exactly how things, electrons, if I were to inject electrons in one side of the system, how would the electron would go through the entire, through the structure and get to the other side. What fraction of it will make it? So geometry is not enough. So the second thing many people talk about is called a percolation theory, again for a random system. And the idea is that when you have very few sticks, if you send an electron from one side, more than likely that it will not make it to the other side, because there is no connected path. And so you can see in number one on the bottom that as a function at low density, the conductivity is essentially zero, because no path from left to the right. If you were to increase the density a little bit, then of course you could expect that if you inject an electron on one side, then a fraction of it will be able to come out to the other side. But of course it is not very dense, so therefore not all the electrons will be able to come out, and therefore the conductivity at that density will be low. If you further increase the density, this time of course if you inject electrons in, there are many paths for the electrons to go from the left to the right, and therefore the conductivity will rapidly increase. And if you increase the density even more, then of course you will have even more conductivity. So this curve is not a continuous curve. This is the essence of percolation theory, that this is not a continuous curve. At number one, you have very low conductivity, essentially absolutely zero, and then eventually you have a high conductivity. And the two things are of interest. One is, this is called a percolation threshold, that at what the point at which the current begins to increase, and the other is how it increases. For example, the exponent t is a fundamental parameter. Lots of research in last 40 years on this topic. So this is one. This is something we'd like to know. Remember, because my goal is the carbon nanotube and silicon nanowire, this is a stick percolating system, and I'd like to know the properties of those. The other thing that one has to be careful about is that in an infinite system, what I told you about is an infinite system, the conductivity going from one point to another. But if you are just talking about a finite system, that is, you put two electrodes shown here in squares on the top, here and here, and put two electrodes at random positions but separated by same distance, and the distance is small, then of course you expect that there may be, although the infinite system may carry no current, that in infinite system you inject electron on one corner, it may not be able to come out to the other corner. However, locally there may be connected path. And so, that at a given density, for a finite system, at a given density, there can be conductivity, although for infinite system, there may be none. So these are the background material that one has to remember. Now the question is, at what density things begins to percolate, that you can go from one point to the other. And for disk percolation, where instead of sticks, so we start with the simpler systems where the elements are small disks, and you want to know at what point that the disk will essentially connect from the left contact to the right contact, then one can do something very simple. You see, these are little disks, and I want to know at what point the left contact will get connected to the right contact. And for that, it's very simple, because you know the area of individual disks is essentially pi d squared over 4, and the density at which it will begin to percolate is approximately 1 divided by pi d squared over 4. So anytime the percolation threshold, the bigger the density, bigger the diameter, easier it is to percolate. Fewer disks you need in order for the electrons to go from one side to another. So this would be for disk percolation. What will you do for stick percolation? Because that's what we are interested in. Because in that case, one option is to think this sticks like a disk. So you make up a disk with that same diameter. But the only problem is that as soon as they are slightly aligned, misaligned, for example, the red one and the black one, then the conductivity will be broken. So I cannot exactly use the previous formula. But it turns out that if we push them into each other such that they are separated not by their diameter, but essentially half the diameter, at that point, all the sticks begin to percolate through each other. And in this case, there will be a factor 4 on the numerator that essentially accounts for the fact that you have to get the disk close enough, sticks close enough, before they percolate, and you will have a percolation threshold that goes as 4 squared divided by pi ls squared, ls being the length of the sticks. So if you have longer sticks, it will take fewer sticks to go from one side to the other. And if you spend a lot of hours on computer, the exact result will be like 4.26 squared rather than 4 squared, but the point is approximately this is a correct result. So that's about threshold. Now the point I wanted to make after all this is that although there have been a lot of work on the theory of this percolating system, it turns out there is very little experimental demonstration that these ideas are actually relevant for actual systems. So for example, in 1970s, people used to punch holes in a conducting paper. And at the point when there were enough holes so that there is no conducting path from left to the right, the current would all on a sudden drop. That is how people used to verify percolation theory. And these days, even up to 2002, people have this bismuth cluster growing, and gradually the diameter gets larger and larger. At some point, there is conduction between the left contact to the right contact and a jump in the current. And this is the status of how percolation theory was being verified. So the bottom line is that we have both Poisson line process, which is good, lots of information about geometry. We have percolation theory, which is also great, but gives you a lot of information, but nothing that you can directly use to describe the problem that we are working with. So we have to start from the beginning. Now there are four phases with which we can analyze the problem. The first is if the stick length LS is larger than the channel length, and if the density is very dilute density and density is lower than the threshold density. I'll explain in a second, this cannot happen. Because anytime you have a stick which is larger than the channel length, if you throw enough of them, there'll be one or two which will definitely bridge from the left to the right. So the one that we will be discussing is when the sticks are longer than the channel length and is automatically always above the percolation threshold. This has application in microelectronics, and there are analytical models to describe it. There's also a case, then the other limit is when the stick length is smaller than the channel length, so that individual sticks cannot bridge from left to right. However, this I'm not going to describe here. This has application in organics. And finally, the system where you have stick length smaller than the channel length, but you have many of them, so that you can go from the left to the right by essentially hopping from one stick to the next, and finally get the current out from the other side. So I'll be talking about two, the one application in microelectronics and the other in macroelectronics. So let's start with the microelectronics application. And the system we are talking about, we are looking at a top view, and we have a source. The white region is source, the yellow is drain, and the electrons are flowing from the source to drain, and you have thrown a random set of sticks. Remember, this is the stick that we grew on top of silicon substrate. These are silicon nanowire carbon nanotube, and this could be on plastic substrate. So we throw it in, and we want to compute the current through such a system. As you can realize, that there is no percolation threshold for this one. Given the sticks are always larger, there will be one which will be making it from the source to drain anyway all the time. And so, therefore, there is no threshold for percolation. The question is, how would you analyze such a system like this? I mean, I have never seen like anything like this in a textbook. So what to do? It turns out that one can very easily and analytically compute this current through such a structure. And the idea is very simple. The idea is that if you take a stick that is a certain distance away from the, let's say, the source gate edge, and preserving that distance, if you bring all the sticks that starts from the same distance away from the stick, then you can very quickly realize that it will make a fan for starting from that point, and then there will be a certain specific angle, because the stick length, there is a certain stick length compared to the channel length, so it will make a maximum angle. If it makes angle farther than that, of course it will not bridge. Now, if you start a slightly distance away from the channel, again you will have another fan, but this time the angle will be narrower. Of course, because this time, of course, it cannot make it all the way through. And all you need to compute the current through such a structure is to sum up these fans. And the way you would sum up is you have a theta m as a function of x, which is the extent of the fan, opening of the fan, and that depends on the position x, where the fan started from. You sum them up, you immediately get a current expression for number of sticks which will make bridge from source to drain, and then you get an expression for that number. This is really amazing. To me, it really looks amazing that such a random structure on the left eventually yields such a beautiful compact expression on the right. And you can numerically computationally verify that this formula is correct. I initially thought that this must be a completely new way of thinking about this problem. It turns out that's not really the case. There is a very famous problem that connected probability theory with geometry, and that is called the Buffon needle problem. And the idea was that if you have a set of lines and you throw a needle, what is the probability that it will going to cross one of the lines? And this is one of the ways you can compute the value of pi. It turns out in during the First World War, many prisoners used to sit in their cell and compute the value of pi this way, to spend time. It turns out the only difference here, what we have done is instead of thinking about a series of lines and one needle, we have taken two parallel lines and a bunch of needles. So essentially it's exactly the same idea that allows you to make this connection between probability and number of sticks that can percolate through. And in fact, then once you know the number of sticks, you can compute the current through this. For example, if this channel length is so short that there is no scattering going from source to drain, then in that case, you will simply have to sum up the current through each one of the sticks. And the function F1 simply says the voltage dependence of individual current through individual stick. You will sum them up, you'll get an expression. You can also do it in the diffusive limit. In the diffusive limit, only difference is that every stick has a current which is inversely proportional to the intercept within the channel. That will go as 1 over Li. So every stick will have that weight. And then again, you can do the sum over that. You can do it in the velocity saturated regime. And you can do it in the intermediate regime, where there is a combination of ballistic and diffusive transport. You can go through them all. This really takes maybe an hour or two of your time. Generally, it should be okay. And Ninad can do it faster than others. And then at the end, you will get a current expression for current, and those will decompose into parts, that is geometrical component that depends on the density of the tubes you have, the length of the tube, the channel length, all those things, the factor G, and then there will be electrical component that depends on the gate voltage and the drain voltage and so on and so forth. Not complicated at all, and then I'm not going through this expressions, but the point is you can very quickly get the expressions by simply integrating the previous sum. But let's talk about the physics of this problem. And the interesting thing is that after you have done this, if you plot it, the corresponding curves will actually look like a regular MOSFET. At a given VG, for example, at a given VD, you can compute for different density. For example, this is a calculation for a given density and for a given channel length, it looks like a MOSFET curve. Only thing is that you realize that this is not exactly a typical MOSFET. Because think about it, some of the sticks which are directly bridging with a narrow angle, they may be in the velocity saturated regime because at a given voltage. But those which are at an angle, for example, the green ones which are at an angle, they may be in the linear regime. So although this looks like a MOSFET, this is really a combination of all the sticks, different sticks doing different things. And that at the end you can get an analytical expression out of it really appears surprising to me. And in fact, what I just wanted to point out that depending on where you are, the fraction of the electrons that are going through diffusive transport versus those in the velocity saturated regime, that can gradually change. But still, the analytical expression should be able to capture them all. This is good. And in fact, you can again explain them, explain experimental data with them. For example, this is the channel length dependence of the current. So you have different channels of different lengths. And the ELO curve, solid ELO curves, are experimental data. And you can explain that there are three effects. For example, there are this channel length dependence effect because number of sticks that can bridge from source to drain, that changes depending on the channel length. The longer channel, same stick length, fewer of them will be able to bridge. So therefore, you have a channel length dependence that comes purely from that. And then you also realize that longer tubes which are at an angle, they will scatter more before the electrons can come out of the drain. So that will be the middle panel, the effect of scattering. And then all the sticks are not exactly the same length, so that will also give you a distribution of length. So when you put these effects together, you can explain the experiment very well. Although this is great, it turns out that there is a far more convincing proof that really shows that you really need to think about the problem in this way. Any other way wouldn't really work. And this is this particular problem. And this is called a metallic filtering of the metallic tubes problem. You know, one third of the metallic tubes, one third of the carbon nanotube is actually metallic. So generally, if you just put it in, then this transistor will not be very useful because one third of them there which are metallic, shown here in red sticks, they will short the source and drain. So you will not have any transistor. So the question is, in order to make it a transistor, you first must filter out all the metallic tubes. And the way people filter it out, that they put a negative gate bias so that all the semiconducting tubes turn off and then put a very high drain bias such that the metallic tubes then burn off. But the puzzle is this, that if you take a shorter channel device, which is the shorter blue region, and compare it with a longer channel device which has a much thicker blue region, channel is longer. And then if you look at a given barn voltage, how the device is behaving, something remarkable happens. And this is this. So the x-axis is barn pulse and y-axis is on current. Let's just focus on the black 230 nanometer line and the blue triangle 90 nanometer line. Before you have put any barn pulse, you have barned anything, so lots of metallic tubes everywhere, then initially you see the 90 nanometer device actually has higher current. Of course, because it's a shorter channel device, and of course there will be more current. And 230 nanometer device has lower current, longer channel, fine. But as you increase the barn pulse, so you are gradually filtering away the metallic tubes, at some point the whole thing flips. That actually a 230 nanometer device has higher current than a 90 nanometer device. Why would this happen? I mean, this is not obvious. It turns out that although it's not obvious to us, it turns out that if you do the simulation, the trend comes out to be exactly right. That this is experiment, for example, you see the reversal in the current, and simulation looks predicts the same thing, and similarly you can look at the on-off ratio. So what is happening? So what is happening is this, that when you have no barn pulse, then you have this fan, and the fan for the blue one is actually much wider because it's a shorter channel device. So for the same stick length, you have a much wider fan. For the red, same stick length, a narrower fan. Fine, and therefore you have fewer of them crossing in the red case, and also they are longer in channel length, so fewer, less amount of current. That is understood. But what happens when you start putting a barn pulse is something quite dramatic. Because in this case, the blue one, a certain fraction of the middle of the fan will open up and will be burned out. This is for the blue one, and there will be some which will remain. For the red one, however, and this is the crux of the puzzle, that the red one, the opening of the fan will be far fewer, or far, it will be far narrower in angle. And the reason is simply that we know that for a given barn pulse VB, since it requires a certain amount of current in order to barn a pulse, let's say a certain amount of current, whatever that amount is, a fixed number. So for a given VB, all sticks that have length smaller than LB, the critical length, all of them will burn. But the value of LB defines a much bigger angle on a shorter channel device than on a longer channel device, because the same LB makes a far bigger angle on a shorter channel device. And therefore, what happens that although in the beginning the current was more for the blue, there will be a point at which the remaining number of blue sticks will actually be smaller than the red sticks, and that will give rise to this flipping effect. So without this fan diagrams, actually one wouldn't be able to explain these experiments. Now I'll go relatively quickly on this other application, and this is on macroelectronics. And the distinction is, I just talked about where the stick length was larger than the channel length. Let me talk about now when the stick length is actually smaller than the channel length. Again, many devices that are based on this technology. And the way you would simulate this structure, this time you cannot do analytical model anymore. This time you need tens of processors, serious computation, have to sit in front of computers and actually do it correctly. And the way you would think about this problem is that every stick in between, you have a drift current and a diffusion current. First term is the drift part and the second is diffusion part. And anytime two sticks crosses each other, there will be a transfer of electrons from one stick to the other, and that is the second current. So it's like a recombination from one current generation in another one. And you can insert the first line of the current into the second one to get a differential equation. And you will solve this differential equation for every stick. If you have 100 sticks, there will be 100 differential equation that you will solve and analyze. two parameters are important. One is, what is the conductivity of individual sticks? So therefore, carbon nanotube will be different from silicon nanowire. And also, when they touch each other, what is the degree of coupling between them? This will be G mutual, mutual conductance and the self-conductance. These two will determine how the sticks actually couple with each other and how electron injected from one side percolate down the network to the other side. First of all, the question I often get is that using drift diffusion theory, I have always done ballistic transport, is it appropriate or not? It turns out that in this case, this is appropriate because we are talking about long channel device, which is several microns long. And these are experimental data which shows that at those lengths, the resistance scales directly with the channel length. So that is scattering dominated, contact doesn't play effect. So drift diffusion transport is just fine for this structure. And moreover, people have done experiments in which they have crossed two carbon nanotubes and looked at the resistance between them. So you can get experimental data from tube-tube coupling, the mutual conductance between them. So self-conductance from the left and mutual conductance from the right, you can use these two information to actually calculate the properties of the network. And the way you would do it, that you would take every sample, generate the sticks at random location, then construct a data structure to see where they actually crossed, how long was the intersection length in between the crossings, and then you will solve the electrical equations, 100 differential equations, and they compute the current flow through source and drain. And then you will do it for many samples, because every sample will be slightly different, and then you will do it for many bias points and construct a curve out of it. And so hopefully that will be consistent with the experiment. And so this is the structure we got from Dr. Hines from Maryland, and there are many data, of course, like that. Looks like a beautiful painting, though. And then you have the corresponding system. But what is amazing, look at this experimental curve. What we are plotting for a given gate bias, we are plotting as a function of channel length the conductivity. So one thing is very good, that as you are, and the symbols are experimental data and the solid lines are simulation. And one thing is obvious, sort of, that as you are making the channel length small, the conductivity is going up, which is obvious, which is fine. And the numbers next to individual lines is called 10. 10 means 10 stick per micron squared. So the top curves have high density, and 1.35 sticks per micron squared is a low density. So high and low density, which is good. And then you look at the conductivity as a function of LC, then the real problem starts, because you see at high density it behaves as 1 over LC, the conductivity that you'd expect from a ohmic conductor. Remember, the gate bias is fixed here. However, at lower density, which is one, let's say 1.35 or 1, whatever, the low number, then this doesn't look like an ohmic conductor. It goes as 1 over L squared almost. And this is therefore a system in which homogenization, remember in the beginning I said about homogenization, that wouldn't work. Because if that theory would have predicted that for all densities, the conductance would go as 1 over LC. What is happening here? So by the way, just to highlight that this is the first known experimental verification of stick percolation. Because the simulation could reproduce, even if you don't understand what is happening, it at least reproduces the experimental data, which is great. Turns out the explanation is very simple and intuitive. So let's start with the thick density, high density. And what we are looking at here, the red, and underneath there is a blue, which you cannot probably see very well. The left hand is source and right hand is drain. We are looking at a top view. And so there is a current flow. At a given channel length, there is a current flow. If you make the channel length smaller by pushing the drain close together, then you make the channel length smaller, and the red ones now have effectively a shorter channel length, so you have a little bit more current. If you push it down even more, then you have even more current, which is fine. This is what you expect out of ohmic conductor. But At low density, the situation is completely different because in this low density is all blue because it's not really percolating from left to right. So the current is much smaller. Then if you push the channel length a little bit close together, all of a sudden one island, which was just incipient island for percolation, all of a sudden that will begin to percolate from left to right. If you push it even more, then all of a sudden there is even the shorter islands, which was just sitting there on its own, will now begin to percolate. So what happens at low density according to this theory is not only that individual length becomes smaller, simultaneously, effectively the width starts getting larger as 1 over LC. So together, it goes as 1 over LC squared. This problem, therefore, the averaging theory wouldn't work. You need specific percolation properties to interpret this data. The other problem, once this was confirmed, the other problem we analyzed was now you fix the channel length and change the gate bias. Because previously it was like just like a linear conductor. Now, of course, it's much more complicated because as you change the gate length, then gradually the conductivity of the semiconducting tubes will keep changing, but the metallic tubes will remain the same. What happens then? And these are the experimental data once again. At low density, the value 1, 3, these essentially reflect number of sticks per micron squared. So at low density, you can see at 1, for example, you have very good on-off ratio, which is the source current, and you can see it's a plot in a log plot, so about 4 orders of magnitude on-off ratio. But at high density, at about 3, something happens, and all of a sudden you lose all of your on-off ratio. And it stops behaving like a transistor. So the question is, what happens then? And it turns out again, once the experiment is done, the symbols are experiments, and simulation and the experiments are the solid lines, you have very good fit. So there must be something fundamental. It's not a random experiment. And what actually happens is this. So let's start with the bottom curve. Why is the bottom curve like that? So let's say you look at the source and drain. And here, the red sticks are metallic sticks, and the blue is semiconducting sticks. At a given density, let's say, the blue forms a percolating subnetwork. So therefore, electron can go from the source to drain through the blue path. But the metallic ones, although there are quite a few, the metallic subnetwork is not percolating. So therefore, it behaves like a semiconducting transistor, just like a silicon transistor. It behaves like that, looks reasonable. What would have happened if I kept increasing the density? So for example, here, what I wanted to say, there's a percolation semiconducting one is larger than the percolation threshold, but the metallic one is not. When the density has increased a factor of 3, and the factor of 3 is crucial, then what happens that the red sticks now begins to percolate on its own. Blue one was of course percolating, and it percolates even better now. But the red one essentially is percolating now, and it can shunt the semiconducting ones and essentially short the source to drain. And therefore, you lose the on-off ratio. Why a factor of 3? Because remember, metallic tube was 1/3 of the total number of tubes. So when you have increased it by a factor of 3, then essentially the metallic network, subnetwork, has started to percolate and shorted this out. And finally, of course, beyond that point, there's no hope. Because if you increase even more, metallic tube will essentially take over. And so this is the reason. And this also gives you a hope that by which, even without removing metallic tubes, if you work in a regime where the semiconducting tube is above percolation, the metallic tube isn't, then you don't have to electrically burn or remove this. You can stay with this technology and still can make a very good transistor out of it. One point that I would like to conclude with, and that was this subthreshold slope. Many times people say that the subthreshold slope arises because you have a thick oxide and therefore you have a poor subthreshold slope. Subthreshold slope is essentially how much the amount of gate voltage you need in order to have one order of magnitude increase in the current. But this is not a regular MOSFET. This is actually a SOI type device because it doesn't have a substrate contact. And in this case, the expression for subthreshold slope is 60 millivolts per decade, which is 2.3 kT over Q, is about 60 millivolt, and then this correction factor, which has the CQ quantum capacitance, the drain capacitance, source capacitance, and the interface capacitance, and of course the COX is the oxide capacitance. Now, in this particular device, its subthreshold regime, CQ is very small, very long channel device, so you can ignore CS and CD, and so it turns out that any deviation from the 60 millivolts per decade, regardless of oxide thickness, is actually a reflection of number of traps you have. And it turns out that very few people realize this, that actually industry-wide, the devices actually are very poor, because this reflection of very poor subthreshold slope actually indicates that approximately perhaps 1 in 100 atoms are not where they are supposed to be. So these are interface traps, and there are many ways you can improve it. You can make the oxide thickness small, COX small, and COX large, and thereby you can make this small. So gate scaling would definitely help. You can make a high K dielectric, that would also help. But the point is that the fundamental problem with this technology up to now is that the value of interface traps is significant, and that's sort of understandable because it's solution processing. There are polymers here, and there are, you are doing a low temperature processing, so there may be a lots of interface traps. So people need to find a way to fix this, because without that, the amount of voltage you need to turn this transistor on is just too big. So I will sort of end here. I'll just probably in the next part of the talk, we'll be talking about perhaps the organic ones, where it's again, stick length is smaller than the channel length, but instead of the what we just discussed, this being larger than the threshold, percolation threshold, the value is actually smaller than the percolation threshold. It turns out that this can significantly enhance the performance of organic transistors. So that's something important to see. And even in here, the question is that what if the tubes are, instead of they are randomly oriented, what if they are more aligned? What would happen in those cases? Again, percolation theory, the way I presented it, provides a consistent way to view all those problems in a unified manner. So I'll end with this. So the bottom line is, I hope you get a feeling, the big picture, that there is, of course, Moore's law and Pentium and microprocessors, yes, a big area. But there is an equally big and exciting area about macroelectronics, where you are talking about larger electronics, these 42-inch TVs, LCD displays, and all those things. And a big wave may be coming, which will be exciting. It will be very exciting to be a part of that. And the other part is that in order to describe those devices, the classical theories we sort of know of, it doesn't really work. And this is for the first time we have to bring in the percolation ideas into device analysis. And once you do that, it looks like lots of things which look random, both on the microelectronics front and the macroelectronics front, they turn out to be consequences, predictable consequences of very elemental properties. So I showed you how to use fan diagrams. I hope that will be something very useful. Electrical filtering is essential, and there are protocols by which you can determine the size for which electrical filtering will be optimum. And then there are many applications on this that people have been talking about. On the macroelectronics side, the most important problem for this technology, I think, is the interface traps. People should be focusing a lot more attention here rather than optimizing the oxide thickness and other properties. Those comes free almost, but the interface trap will require some work before the technology is actually viable for widespread applications. So that's it. Thank you. if there are questions.
How do you model the gate control in these devices?
Gate control? What do you mean by that?
So if it's a single transistor, then we can solve Poisson equation and know how much gate charge there is. Now, if there is a network of transistors, how to calculate charge?
Right. So that was an issue that we grappled with. So I can probably, the way we do it for, in this particular problem, these are all linear response, meaning that here the drain voltage is small, about 100 millivolts, and the gate voltage is high. So in this case, you do not need to solve for the two-dimensional Poisson equation coming from the drain and the gate together, because essentially its gate induces a certain carrier density, and based on that carrier density, you can find the conductivity through such a system. So Poisson equation doesn't come explicitly through the solution. But when you want to solve for the full IV characteristics, large drain bias and large gate bias, in that case, you have to solve, ideally, full 3D system self-consistently, Poisson equation. But it turns out that since this device is large, and since even at percolation, you need at least 50% of the sticks to be there, so a one-dimensional solution of the Poisson equation turns out to be remarkably good. So the answer would be this. In this particular case, here the Poisson equation is very simple. It's just reflected in the carrier density alone. You don't really need to solve the full 3D problem here.
In this IST versus VT curve, when you are increasing the metallic tube density, you are getting that metallic tube is actually shunting the semiconductor tubes. But the metallic tubes is not behaving like your ohmic contacts, like your ohmic property. It is not showing the ohmic property.
You are talking about this.
It is sitting as a constant on this.
So you are talking about the magenta line and then?
The magenta and the higher ones.
Higher ones. Because that, why is it not? First of all, it's a log plot, so I'm not 100% sure that once you put it in a linear plot, whether how much deviation there would be from linearity, from Ohm's law. But the idea is that you always have the semiconducting network sitting underneath it, and although always its density is significantly higher. And when you are in the on state, in a fully on state, then the conductivities are comparable. So therefore, you will always have these two pieces that will compete against each other. When you are in the off state, 2/3 of the semiconducting tubes are gone. So it will not always be completely linear, because you have a variable fraction that is sort of multiplying the prefactor, or working as a prefactor. Yes?
Professor, when the length of the tube is bigger than the channel length, so why is there that angle dependence? I mean, if there is a pipe connecting two reservoirs, there should not be any angle dependence on how the pipe is.
Okay, so should we go back? It may be a little bit. Which one do you want? This one would be good, or?
Sir, in that mathematical expression, there was that cos inverse term.
Oh, I see. This one? Okay, so depends on where you start, so where the X is. X is the origin. So if some of the sticks begin here, let's say this distance is 10 angstrom, let's say. And so anyone that starts from 10 angstrom away would all be grouped together. And they can be lying in random angles. So that gives you a length. But the number, of course, more will be able to bridge from source to drain because it's close by, and for the same length, it will make a wider angle. Right? And then, of course, you have to sum over all x. And this theta m, so you can write it as cosine inverse of this. Because you can, you need this channel length plus x and divided by this ls, cosine inverse of that. The only variable unknown is x. So you integrate between 0 to LC. And then that gives you, or LS, that gives you this expression. Right? So the thing is, there are many ways. You can either integrate over x first, or you can integrate over theta first. Both ways would work and give you the same answer. But did I answer your question? No.
I think what I get from what you said is that since there are different lengths, so you are bunching all those lengths.
No, not same length.
Yes,
different orientations.
By orienting them differently, those lengths are different.
Yes, effective length is different. But here I am just counting number of sticks that went through. So here I am not counting how the length actually affects the transport. In order to do that, these are the factors that you have to. If there is no length dependence, if it's ballistic transport which does not depend on length, then your weighting factor will be 1. And then you will do the integral directly. If, on the other hand, it depends on length, so a shorter tube actually is less resistant than the longer one, then you have this 1 over L in front of the sum. And then you do the sum. So then, of course, the result will be different. So any dependence you have, then you put it in the prior factor, in the integral, and then evaluate it. Yes?
Some of my colleagues at the Naval Research Laboratory are making carbon nanotube tech fabrics. Have you been modeling some of their work at all?
So,
the authors on your list of one of those guys.
So, in fact, the people who are most active, at least, probably your list. I think this is a good place to acknowledge. Oh, this may be. Yeah, so Eric Snow is from Naval Research Lab.
Ah, yes, okay.
Eric Snow is Naval Research Lab.
Right, okay.
Gabriela Blanchett and the Columbia group, they work on organics, the topic that we did not discuss today. Eric Snow and Nanomix, these are the two big players in this area. So they have beautiful results coming out almost every month. And then Paco Leon and many other nanocysts, they work on silicon nanotube. And the problem is this carbon, this metallic tubes, because that you have to remove this metallic tubes before you make them, make a transistor out of it, is a big problem. So at the end, therefore, many companies have decided that it is not worth it and it's better to directly go to semiconducting tubes. The problem with semiconducting tubes is when you cross to metallic tubes, is a nearly perfect contact, and the conductance is really fundamental because it very effective transfer of electrons from one to the next. On the other hand, when you put two silicon together, they essentially do not have any conduction between them because of the insulating properties you have. Fermi silicon dioxide. Pardon me?
Fermi level pinning.
Exactly, in between the surfaces. So therefore, in silicon area, therefore you always have to stay in the regime where LS, stick length, is larger than the channel length. Then you make the transistor. And you go to the other side, it's also fine because then you don't have to remove metallic tubes and you can work with the carbon nanotubes. So this is what looks like the status right now. Any other questions? Okay, that's it. Thank you.